Great question. The Manufacturing Podcast offers news and information for the people who make, store, and move things, and those who manage and maintain the facilities where that work gets done. Hi, everyone, and welcome to a special Saturday episode of Great Question, a Manufacturing Podcast. You have stumbled onto our 2024 Oscars extravaganza, where we're going to talk about some of the movies that have made us think about the reliability, maintenance, and manufacturing mindset. Today, you've got four editors in Endeavor Business Media's Manufacturing Group. You've got Laura Davis, the chief editor on New Equipment Digest.
Hey.
We got Anna Townsend, the managing editor of Plant Services.
Howdy.
And Alexis Kajewski, the senior content strategist for Plant Services.
Hey, everybody.
And you know my voice at this point. I'm Tom Wilk, the chief editor on Plant Services. And we have gathered today to talk about movies, which is a little bit different for us. The idea for this podcast came from a session at Fluke Accelerate last year, where the presenters started off their session with the Darth Vader's theme from The Empire Strikes Back. And they said they did that in honor of their favorite movie about reliability, The Empire Strikes Back, where the Millennium Falcon breaks down exactly when you wish it wouldn't. Even the animals in the snow planet die when you wish they wouldn't. Everything goes wrong in that movie. So the four of us got together like, there's got to be some other movies that we've seen which talk about either health and safety or the manufacturing life or what it's like to depend on a machine to protect your life. And I think we got an interesting lineup of movies today. I'm going to pass over to Alexis Kajewski, who's going to kick us off with our first movie. Alexis, which one do you want to talk about today?
Okay, so I selected a movie that takes a hard look at the food and beverage industry, particularly confectionery products, and the many health, safety, and sanitary issues that arise. And of course, I'm talking about Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I know. Everyone saw it coming. So for those of you,
beverage industry.
Of course. It's practically a documentary at this point. So if anybody hasn't seen it, I'd be totally surprised. But it's based on the classic novel by Roald Dahl. It is a movie musical from 1971. Basically, it's the story of Charlie Bucket, a poor but kind-hearted kid who finds a golden ticket in a chocolate bar and wins to visit Willy Wonka's chocolate factory and get the chance at a lifetime supply of chocolate. As we go on, madness ensues as Charlie, his grandfather, four other children, and their parents see firsthand how the chocolate is made. No, it's not Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, but it's not far off. When you watch the movie as a kid, you see it as this like beautiful, whimsical romp through a world where anything is possible. But when you watch it as an adult, all you see are labor violations, safety hazards, research and development fails, and corporate espionage. So that's the lens I watch this movie through, because I can't just take things at face value. I have to look at them, you know, and I looked at it more with an industrial view. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was the obvious labor violations that they have at the factory. It's very, very clear that the Oompa Loompas that run the factory are undocumented workers. When you see the kids' reaction to the workers at first, it's very clear that the government and society as a whole is completely unaware of the existence of Oompa Loompas or their native country of Loompa Land. Despite
is
really
the name of the country, Loompa Land?
That is the name of the country.
Wow.
I will have
if
you know.
Never knew where they were from.
Despite their hard work, the Oompa Loompas are paid in cocoa beans, not money. They are never seen leaving the factory, which implies that they both live and work nonstop at the plant. So now with this information, we can view Wonka's facility more like a company town rather than a childlike wonderland.
So it's like Google.
Pretty much. Maybe with a little candy, although I hear they ply you with a lot of food too at Google. So some of the other issues that you run into in that movie are going to be sanitary issues. So Willy Wonka is always encouraging the kids on the tour to touch, taste, and interact with everything they see. And this really not a problem in and of itself until you realize that the manufacturing is happening just, a few steps away from where kids are touching things and putting things in their mouths. Then it's a problem. But one of the most egregious, of course, is when one of the kids starts drinking from the River of Chocolate, which we're told in the movie moves more than 10,000 gallons of chocolate an hour, which means that by drinking, he has contaminated untold amounts of product. And it only gets worse when he eventually falls into the river and is sucked up into a pipe. Despite Willy Wonka being very upset about his chocolate being contaminated, he has absolutely no problem riding in a boat along that same chocolate river. So, you know, child falling in bad. Wooden boat going through, perfectly fine.
So. Wait, Augustus Gloop falling into that river and going up the pipe, that really scared me as a kid of many scary things in the movie. He never came back. I thought this might happen like in the shower. What happens if you fall down the pipe and never come back?
I thought that boat ride was terrifying as a child. I don't know what's going on in that tunnel, but it was scary.
We're not even going to talk about the psychedelics that must be being also made at that facility. So how else do you explain that scene? If you get into the, when they go into the inventing room, you see Wonka is touching and tasting all of the product and all of the raw material, plus is throwing everyday objects like shoes and clocks into different pots and pans all throughout, which, ew, just ew. This will make you never want to eat chocolate again. Now that you watch it as an adult, you will have, you know, no interest in it whatsoever. And then, of course, most importantly and closest to my heart, since I report on a lot of OSHA incidents for plant services, is all the safety violations that exist. So when the kids first enter the factory, Wonka says, "Little surprises around every corner, but nothing dangerous." And that's just a bold-faced lie. Wonka knows it. We all know it. No, just a lie. Because 2 seconds later, he's asking them to sign a contract that reads, "The management cannot be held responsible for any accidents, incidents, loss of property or life or limb." They know. They 100% know. Anyway, here are just a few smatterings of the many safety violations that you will see at the plant. There are no guardrails around the chocolate river, just in case children or workers might fall in. There's no safety plan in place to help visitors and employees when perfectly foreseeable accidents occur. There's no guarding on any machines throughout any part of the facility. The Oompa Loompas rarely wear PPE or protective gear. When they're in the inventing room, there's large pots with exposed boiling liquids. Several machines are producing smoke and steam that is not trapped or vented. There are obstructed walkways. There's raw material being spilled all over the floor, causing slip and fall hazards. The fan in the ceiling of the fizzy lifting room is unguarded and almost kills two people.
That's nightmare number two for me, that fan. I don't even want to tell you how many nightmares I had about that one.
Is this just Tom's nightmare movie? Is that what I selected?
Well, I mean, it's going to chop you, right? If you don't do the right thing. And that there was no way to know how to get out of that. I'm not even sure burping is a solution, because what if you can't burp? Chop, chop, chop.
The Wonka-mobile has no seat belts, and it spews chemicals all over the riders. And, of course, most importantly is the great glass elevator, which can move in any sort of direction and classically just goes right through the ceiling. I don't think we really have to say anything more about that. But so, yes, that was my selection. It was fun to rewatch it. And as Tom has already pointed out, extremely terrifying.
Well,
they don't even give you any PPE to wear.
It's so true. It's so true.
Something that helped me come to terms with that years later was that at a science fiction convention, unannounced, I got to meet two of the actors from the movie.
Which two actors did you get to meet?
I got to meet Violet's father, a guy named Leonard Stone. He's sort of an old classic Hollywood guy, both TV series and Hollywood movies. And this is the big one. I got to meet Mike Teeby.
What size was he? Was he like your size?
He was life size, and he had moved into selling like real estate in Los Angeles, but he heard about this convention. He's like, I'll bring some photos to sign. His name is Paris Themen. He couldn't have been nicer, and a lot of my friends couldn't have been more mean about it. They didn't treat him meanly, but it's become a running joke. Like, if you can't get the autograph you want in the convention now, you just go see Mike TV. He'll sign for you. But yeah, he was a very nice guy. And I didn't tell him at all about the nightmares that I had. It was just nice to shake his hand and see him in person.
Do you have terrors about the whole Mike TV, you know, being transported and shrunk down?
Not the TV. I'd say third place was the girl who ate the blueberry and blew up. That's really mine. Huge. Was that yours, Laura?
Yeah. I was like, oh no, that can happen.
I just love that people had nightmares, and I was like, I want to be Veruca Salt. How do I get to that point? I also want things now. I want that instant gratification. How do I go about achieving that?
No, I kind of wanted Paris Themen to be wearing white when I met him as Mike TV, but he was not wearing the white TV suit. He was just wearing regular clothes. Well, let's move from a food processing plant over to a different food plant, one that manufactures extracts. Anna, you picked a very specific movie when it came to this, right?
Okay, yes. And very well done, Alexis. Very good research. I had to make this hard on myself because I wanted to talk about a movie that I've never seen before. So I did some search and I came across this 2009 film called Extract. So it looked like it had some potential. It's a Mike Judge film. We're talking Beavis and Butthead, King of the Hill, Office Space, Idiocracy. I should have just picked Idiocracy because I actually have a really awesome and funny story about Crocs in that movie. Maybe I'll tell that at the end if we have some time. But that's really the only thing about that movie that is about manufacturing. But I digress. So unfortunately, this movie Extract is about manufacturing. But it has a decent cast. We've got Jason Bateman, Ben Affleck, Kristen Wiig, and Mila Kunis. I mean, it sounds great, right? I thought. And I mean, I should have known. There's a reason this is the only Mike Judge movie we've never heard of, right? Anybody heard of it before I mentioned it?
No.
No.
Yeah. So basically, I have to tell everyone the plot of this movie that they've never seen because it's terrible. But I will focus on manufacturing. So Jason Bateman is Joel Reynolds. He owns Reynolds Extract, a flavoring extract manufacturer. And so growing up, his mom used to make these root beer cookies. And, you know, witty little Joe, he noticed that the dough always tasted better than the cookies themselves because the flavoring is essentially baked off during the cooking process. As a graduate student in chemistry, that's all we know, he figured out a way to use a synthetic derivative of the wintergreen component to make an extract that essentially doesn't evaporate as easily. And from that, he created his amazing extract business. You only know this because Mila Kunis plays Cindy, who is basically a sociopath con artist who is pretending to be interested in Joe's extract science so she can get a job at the factory, woo the worker who has recently got injured there, and stands to win a whole bunch of money. So yes, that's right, folks. We've got a workplace injury on the plant floor. There is quite a bit of automation in their production line, but it's constantly being shut down by their sort of incompetent and difficult operators. At one point, the line backs all the way up and extract falls over and spills. Somebody slips in that and goes down. The forklift driver, who has already been established as a terrible forklift driver, you know, he slams on the brakes of his forklift to avoid running over his coworker, and the top pallet of his extract falls on the compressed air system, which sends a projectile straight at one of the workers. So I'm not exactly sure what this guy does, but he's carrying a wrench. So I really want to call him the maintenance worker. And we know also that he's trying to get promoted to floor manager. So because I'm trying to keep this PG, I won't describe his injury in detail. But of the two body parts he lost in the accident, one was toast and they were hoping the other they could attach. The newspaper headline calls it a mid-body injury. So we also learned prior to this that Joe has received a possible buyout offer from General Mills. And he's hoping to retire. But the workplace injury, the potential lawsuit, it could just put it all in jeopardy. Oh, no. So J.K. Simmons plays a pretty terrible and sort of racist manager. He doesn't know anybody's name. He calls them all dingus. He's constantly complaining about the employees. He wants to fire them. At one point, they're standing in their sort of window office overlooking the plant floor, watching somebody who apparently is not doing their job. And Joel asks, are we still looking into replacing her with a robot? And the manager reminds him, you might not have to if they sell to General Mills. The one funny movie highlight is Gene Simmons as the skeevy personal injury lawyer representing the injured worker. He's got some great hair and some great lines. And you get a long-haired, bearded Ben Affleck as Joe's apathetic bartender friend who basically just keeps giving him drugs so he makes bad decisions. J-Lo would never let him make this movie now, but it's funny to see what he would do 15 years ago. In the end, there's no lawsuit. Joel doesn't sell his beloved company. And he tells that manager, he better start learning everybody's name. That's right. That's all I got.
Yeah. You know, I just watched this recently, too. And it was better than I thought it was going to be. But I'm with you where it's for Mike Judge, it's Fair to Partly Cloudy.
It's super cringy. And I love cringe, but like it doesn't earn the cheesy moments with enough good comedy. It was little over the top.
Yeah. Gene Simmons was spectacular in this, as he always is in movies.
It was a short part, but it kind of made the film.
Yeah. I like how they found him because he put in ads on some bus benches. And suddenly
definitely the best way to find a lawyer.
Right.
Speaking of Ben Affleck and J-Lo, someone's going to need to watch her new movie because I saw clips where she is dancing and singing in what looks like a welding factory with no protective clothing on. So
this might apply.
Part two for our podcast.
It looks super bizarre and really dumb. I don't know who let her make it, but someone needs to watch it.
This sounds even better than Glitter.
It probably will be.
Do you want to keep us going, Laura, with your movie?
Yeah, mine takes a bit of a darker turn. So I chose a sci-fi movie called Ex Machina. It was made in 2014, so a good 10 years ago. And it's basically about a robot uprising. So there's this programmer named Caleb. He works at an internet company. He wins this contest to go stay with his CEO in like the middle of nowhere in this big mansion, very luxurious. And it actually turns out to be this research facility. And it's just him and his CEO. And the research he's going to be doing there for the week is he's going to be conducting a Turing test of sorts on this new AI robot that is boss built. And the boss wants to know if he thinks the robot has consciousness when the week is over. So he meets this robot. Her name's Ava, and she looks extremely similar to the real life Sophia robot made by Hanson Robotics in 2016. So Ava's got the synthetic skin on her face, like her entire head, and synthetic skin on her hands. Everywhere else looks like a machine, but in the form of the human body. Over the week, they have like these sessions where the programmer Caleb is talking to her and they're having these conversations and they start bonding and she's displaying like frustration, inquisitiveness, remorse, sadness. She's very curious about things. She wants to know about him. She starts displaying that she likes him and they could go on a date and they could go people watch in a city at a traffic intersection. So the programmer's like mad now at his boss. He's like, why did you like give her a gender and sexuality? Like, did you program her to like me? His boss is like, no, like she has a gender just because that's inherent to humans. But she's not pretending to like you. That's just what she's doing. I'm like, okay, whatever. So he hatches this plan with her to help her escape. And in this whole plan that comes out, the boss says, I could hear everything you were planning with her. There's a camera in there that you didn't know about. And actually, you were the real Turing test to see if she could manipulate you to help her escape. So the boss gave Ava, the robot, like this hope of he showed her the programmer's picture and said, this guy's coming. You need to use like your charm, your wit, manipulate him into helping you escape. And he's like, that was the test to see if she was ready for that. So everyone knows about everything, but what they didn't plan for is that Ava is smarter than all of them, and instead of stopping the test, takes over, causes these power shutdowns, locks them in, kills the CEO, goes and finds the rest of the AI models, takes their synthetic skin, wigs, clothing, puts it all on so you wouldn't be able to tell she's a robot, and grabs the helicopter that's coming to get the programmer to go back home for the week. No one knows what happened. She's the only one, and now she's in the world on her own. There's a lot more to that movie. If no one's seen it, it won't spoil too much, hopefully, but it gave the ending away. But it's kind of crazy, given that now in our society and what's going on with the rise of AI and ChatGPT and everything, you know, we're always talking about, can AI be sentient? Can robots be sentient? And the answer's always been no. However, at what point does AI become able to teach itself? Like, where is that line? And where do we say, hey, maybe we're not going to go past this point with this technology, which will be never. They're going to keep going. We all know it. But it's just really interesting that it was made 10 years ago. It's going to be relevant for a very long time. I mean, you also have like iRobot, which did somewhat of the same thing. But this one was done very well. It was very creepy. At one point, the programmer even goes into a bathroom and cuts open his arm because he doesn't know if he's a robot. Like, he is so turned around in reality. So it's crazy. I don't know. It really rocked my mind when I watched it.
I love a movie with a happy ending. Scary. Oh, this is a human gone bad movie. This is not an AI gone bad. This is a human gone bad.
The boss was bad. He was only making women robots. He was keeping them locked up. So they won.
You root for Ava. I'm like, yeah, you do it. Go robot. We've had a good run. It's okay.
There are like no checks and balances, though. He was so worried about his, you know, proprietary tech, and so secretive that nobody knew this was happening. No one knows to come and check on them if something goes wrong. Like, this facility is still just sitting there. Anyone could get into. Now that, I mean, Caleb's locked in a room, going to starve to death. No one knows he's there. Where are your checks and balances?
It sounds like an interesting update to a lot of the themes that were brought up in Blade Runner. About 20, 25 years earlier, I always remember the scene where Harrison Ford, after interviewing Rachel, the robot in Blade Runner, talks to her creator and says, how can it not know what it is? And the irony is that, of course, we eventually found out he's a robot himself. And so it starts to play with your sense of how do you know who you are? How do you know?
Are we going to get into the is Decker a robot debate? Like, are we going to do this? Are we doing this now, Tom?
Well, there's no debate, but we can do it for the next episode.
Oh, no. There's definitely a debate to be had on that front. Why did none of us bring up Blade Runner 2, by the way?
I need to watch it. I have not seen it all the way through.
All right. Another movie for part two.
100%
robot. No. That was an afterthought. The scene with the unicorn was added later on after the initial release. Decker is not a robot. The movie falls apart if Decker is a robot.
You know, it also brings up, I can't believe I forgot about it, but Westworld, at least the first season.
It's so interesting to me to, because we're in this AI world right now and it's exploding, like, all of our exposure to AI movies is this sort of, like, apocalyptic, scary world where AI takes over. And, like, in our mind, it's science fiction. And I think we've all sort of come to understand that, well, we're creating this, but we are in control. And Laura, you were talking about, like, at what point does AI begin to learn? And that, I mean, that's literally what machine learning is. And we're teaching it to do that right now. Like, how does that not become Skynet? It's interesting. We could go on and on for that, I bet.
I mean, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. Like, I know people who think within 5 years, like, AI will have taken over. I don't think that. I think just with how slow technology actually evolves. But I could see in, like, 15, 20 years, this conversation becoming very poignant. And they need to take a look at things in the name of, you know, not giving in to corporate profit greed by automating everything so well. So we'll see what happens.
I think it's interesting that we have such these like clear ideas of, you know, what it means to be merged with AI or what it would look like in that future. And the idea, I was watching something that was talking about cyborgs, and they were like, cyborgs are already here. You're a cyborg now. You can't exist without your smartphone. It's always at your fingertips. What is the difference if it's embedded in your arm or it's just always in your hand? It's the same exact thing. You're already a cyborg. So I think that's going to be the real future. Is it won't look exactly like we thought, but it's coming. It'll be here soon.
You'll be manipulated by it.
People who use pacemakers, people who use prosthetics. I mean, there's a whole wide variety of ways that science has developed ways to extend missing or defective parts of the human body. And at that point, okay, well, the parts aren't always powered by electricity, but yeah, cyborg is not just a theory at that point.
We're all cyborgs. Right?
Well, I'm going to shift over and build off what Laura was saying about AI and talk about a movie about astronauts. In the 60s, part of the joke around 2001, A Space Odyssey, was that the character with the most personality in that movie was the computer, right? You've got mission specialists from Bowman and Poole. You've got Dr. Haywood Floyd, who all are about as interesting as sandpaper, right? And it's the computer who actually takes action in lateral motion. Well, I'm going to update that into Apollo 13, the movie from 1995. And what struck me about that movie was not that the astronauts were cyborgs or robots, but that to get the damaged spaceship home that they were flying in, they had to be as human as they possibly could. I watched it through a sort of maintenance and reliability mindset to sort of pick out some of the engineering themes that were in this movie. For those who don't know about Apollo 13, long story short, it was the third mission planned to land on the moon. Three astronauts, Lowell, Hayes, and Swigert, were sent up for a week in mid-1970. And about 2 days into the mission, they turned on an oxygen tank to help mix the liquid oxygen. And there was some sort of explosion and a bang, and no one knew what it was, and it crippled the spaceship. So the question quickly became, not are we going to land on the moon, but are we going to even be able to get back to Earth, much less get back to Earth alive? And the explosion happened when they were about, again, 2 days into a 7-day mission, so they weren't even at the moon yet. The movie traces what they did as people in space and also how they work with people back in mission control to solve the problem. And in a couple of quotes, Commander James Lowell says, "There's nothing routine about flying to the moon, I can tell you that." And what that brought to mind was maintenance and asset management technicians who rely on PM routines, but then, hey, the worst incidents at the plant happen that are non-routine. They're catastrophic. They're a surprise. Gene Kranz, the guy here in Mission Control, said, "Work the problem. Let's not make things worse by guessing." And that reminded me of when reliability and maintenance folks do FMEAs in order to find out what the actual problem is, not just the presenting problem, but what is the real fault with the machine that's causing other secondary problems. And one more, Gene Kranz says, "I don't care about what anything was designed to do. I care about what it can do." And I think every engineer who's listening to this is going to pump their fist a little bit because that's the way you solve unique problems, right? You find out not what things something is supposed to do, but what it can do. Reliability depends on machines doing what they're supposed to do, but we've all come across cases where you've got to try and work with that machine and figure out what it can do instead of what it's supposed to do. Real quick thought about living and working inside the machine. I've met a lot of submarine reliability technicians who describe working on a submarine as human beings living and working inside the machine. And that also struck me about Apollo 13. You've got three people in space, very thin wedges of metal protecting them from the vacuum of space. And there is no more isolating definition of working inside the machine than being in that capsule rocketing away from Earth. And then something goes wrong in the spaceship. So I don't know. Have you guys seen Apollo 13 recently, or did you see it back in the day?
Houston, we have a problem.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I've used that many times in my life. But yeah. No, of course I saw it. It's an intense one, you know. You represented it well.
Well, it's an intense story. It's fascinated me for a long time. Even before the movie got made, when I was sort of a science fiction and space nerd in the 1980s, the story of Apollo 13 really grabbed me. And so I remember a lot of friends and family when the movie came out said, wait a second, you knew about this? Because for a long time, it wasn't really part of the conversation. I'm kind of happy it is, because it's a hell of a story. It's an engineering triumph. It's secondary to actually landing someone on the moon safely in 1969. I think this is a close second in terms of triumphing over adversity for the space program. You know, they also liven it up with some humor, too. I talked about the astronauts being human. Well, one of the humans gets sick while they're on the spaceship, and so they got to deal with the secondary commander. Practically, he's got a 100-degree fever. He's shivering. He's throwing up. And at that point, the other two astronauts are just sort of like, all right, let's fix the ship, but also let's fix this guy. Let's protect him. You know, let's get him home on time. There are fights aboard the spaceship. At one point, two of the astronauts go head-to-head over whether Swigert checked the readings on the oxygen tanks before mixing the tanks. And so, you don't have robots in the spaceship. You've got people actually fighting and bickering and working together.
Wouldn't help them.
Well, they made a big thing about getting all the engineers back at Mission Control to help solve problems like how do you replace a circular CO2 filter on one part of the spaceship when the only available slot to put it in is square. And so they threw a bunch of equipment at these guys in Houston and said, okay, we've got to figure out how to put a round peg in a square hole, or else these guys are going to run out of oxygen and suffocate due to the CO2 building up in the spaceship. And with nothing but what they got on board. So they used parts of a paper mission plan. They used some duct tape, of course, duct tape. They used plastic bags, and they did find a way to do it and fix the CO2 scrubbing system. But yeah, just one last note too. Amazingly, like I used to have a poster called Moon Men, where it was everybody who was part of these Apollo missions who had gotten to the moon, and most of them were deceased. And this was, again, back in the 2000s. Two of the three people who came back on Apollo 13 are still alive. And I didn't know that. The commander of the mission and his assistant commander, Lowell and Hayes. James Lowell is 95 years old and Fred Hayes is 90. So talk about, you know, getting home safe. They extended the life by what, 40, 50, 60 years? It's astonishing. I'm so glad they're still with us.
Yeah, it seems like what you're saying is we need to be able to go up into space to extend our youthfulness in our life. Expectancy. Right?
There you go.
Oh, don't say that. That'll be like a TikTok trend now. If you want, you know, skin that never ages, all you have to do is go into space.
You got to get past that ozone layer.
So, yeah, I hope everyone's enjoyed listening to these movies again. It's Ex Machina, it's Apollo 13, it's Extract, and it's Willy Wonka in the OSHA violation-ridden chocolate factory. One more note about Apollo 13, too, is that NASA has its own RCM manual. They built it in the 2000s, and so we'll put that link in the podcast notes along with links to information about the movies. But for those of you who are listening who are more reliability and maintenance-centered focused, the manual is an interesting manual because it does capture the best practices that are promoted by organizations like the SMRP. And NASA basically did it themselves in the 2000s based on interviews with all of their workers and astronauts. So it's several hundred pages, and you can download it for free on the NASA site. If you want to get there before looking at the notes, just look up NASA RCM manual. It'll come up right away. So, well, let me thank Alexis, Anna, and Laura. It's been a lot of fun to do this with you guys.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
Thanks, team. That was fun.
And I will
regular.
Oh, yeah, we got to do this again.
Yeah, we got our Blade Runner debate coming up.
I'm totally right on this. I'm 100% right on this. I will do some research. We'll come prepared next time, Tom.
Well, I hope everyone enjoyed this. And if you're watching the Oscars, have fun watching the Oscars. We'll see you next time at the movies. Bye.